The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because they are hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to a live Space Show program for Friday morning. Thank you very much for tuning in. By way of a brief explanation, as you know, I was at the Starship Congress event in Monterey for the past several days. I did not do any taped interviews there, but I did line up quite a few of the speakers who were very interesting, at least from my perspective, also from the perspective of Space Show associates that were there, Kim, John, Fremont John, as all of you know him, and Dr. Ben Arroyo. And hopefully they will all follow through on their commitment to be guests on the Space Show, and we will be hearing from them between now and the end of the year. One has already locked on to October 10th, John Bucknell. Really interesting propulsion idea. So, as I said, he's going to be on in early October. More about that as we go forward. So today is a live show, and Kim Holder, who all of you know as through her work, her incredible work, and at some point we'll have her presentations from the conference either posted on the website with this show or linked to the Icarus Interstellar YouTube site that is not complete yet. But all of you will absolutely want to hear her presentation followed by our panel, as well as the presentation on lunar engineering and architecture for HABS by Dr. Ben Arroyo. But today is live. If you want to give us a call, 1-866-687-7223, email drspace, drspace, at thespaceshow.com, and, of course, the Space Show blog, which is our website. All the way over to the right is upcoming shows. This is the first show listed. Again, open that page up. That is our archive page for this program. And then you can post comments down at the bottom of the page, and as soon as I get them, I can bring them up and put them into the website. We're on the approximate 60-minute format today, so I'm going to skip quite a few of the upfront announcements to save more time for talking, but I do, again, want to point out two things. We have made some progress in making our podcasts available on TuneIn, and this is for those of you who use Alexa or the Alexa format. And Spencer is waiting for the authorization, and then we will embed their player in the Listen Live section of the show for podcasting instructions. So stay tuned on that. We're just waiting for the tune-in feedback and the embedded player authorization to move forward on that, and I will announce it on the air. Do remember that everything we do is archived, so you can listen off of our website or easily download the show. We are a 501c3 nonprofit, and your support does keep the Space Show on the air. Our parent is onegiantleapfoundation.org. We very much appreciate those of you who do support us, and it is vital in keeping the Space Show going and keeping our content available to all of you free of charge. Remember, as a 501c3, if you're paying U.S. federal taxes, you get a tax deduction. The same is true if you're a Californian paying California taxes, as we're a public benefit corporation in California. Visit our parent, onegiantleapfoundation.org. And if you have any questions about any of this, please do email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then check out our corporate sponsors. Their banner ads go across our website, and we're deeply appreciative of their support. It is also vital to the health and distribution of our content on the Space Show. Because we're doing the 60-minute format, I just want to thank our sponsors. I'm not going to read our messages. So we do have the New Worlds Conference sponsoring us. This is in Austin, Texas, November 10th through the 11th. Rick Tumlinson is working out a special discount for Space Show listeners. So if you are planning to be there or if you're in the Austin area, November 10th through 11th, you'll certainly want to make arrangements to use the Space Show discount. As soon as that is available, I will begin announcing that on the air. We thank Integrated Space Plan. They are also a sponsor. The Space Foundation is also a sponsor. Deeply appreciative of them. The same for Orbital ATK. AIAA is a sponsor. And, of course, Celestis is our sponsor on the corporate side. So we thank all of these organizations. Their support is very much appreciated and very vital for the Space Show. So as I said a few minutes ago, Kim Holder is with me live. She is in San Francisco, staying over a couple of extra days before returning to her home in Mexico. And we're going to assess the Starship Congress for you and tell you about some of the more interesting things that happened. And when their YouTube channel is complete, and I really don't know when that will be, then we will post a link to it for the conference. But we will also, as I said, post the link to Kim's talk, to our panel presentation, which was Kim, myself, John Jossi, or Fremont John, as all of you know him, and Dr. Ben Arroyo. And we will also post the standalone talk that Dr. Ben Arroyo gave. So stay tuned for that. I will announce it, but those links will go up on the blog for today's program. So as I said, Kim is with us. We're going to talk a little bit about the Congress, and you can ask questions. Give us a call. Again, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. And I guess I'll jump into the fray and say a few things. And, Kim, you can enter the discussion whenever you want. So okay. In terms of structure of the conference, it was pretty loosey-goosey compared to most conferences that I attend. Mm-hmm. There were maybe 60, 65 people there at the most. I did make an audience count a few times, and it was sort of approximate because people were going in and out because there weren't that many breaks and the sessions were very long. People ran over with their talks. One day we had a 12-hour day. They did have hackathons planned for the evening, but the two hackathons were canceled because the talks went way over their stated time. And so they finished them up in the evening. They did have a group lunch on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. Their theme, which is Spaces for Everybody, I think in their parlance means access to space, physical access. And Kim can comment on this. Physical access to space is for everybody, not just the benefits of space are for everybody, which is sort of how I interpret that. So they did have presentations about making sure minority groups, disabled groups, other kinds of groups that we don't normally think about were included in the space discussion and being able to go to space. And my take on that is that I've never been to a conference or with a group that has ever had a limitation policy. So I'm not sure how necessary that approach is, but that's a very strong part of Starship Congress. But again, I've never ever seen a policy or heard a policy expressed where any group, any gender, any race, any nationality, any country was excluded or was wanted to be excluded. Space to me, ever since I've been doing this, has been one of the most inclusive disciplines that I've ever come across in my entire life. But that is their theme, and that is a big focus to them. I wish they had been more disciplined in the time of the talks and the structure, because they had a 10-minute break in the morning, broke for lunch, 10-minute break in the afternoon. And honestly, that was not enough given the length of the talks and how over time people went. But they wanted people to be able to say as much as they wanted to say. So they purposely did not enforce times for the conference, which really worked out great for us on the panel because we went way over our time.
Yeah, but in our case, they had a particular reason. They were trying to organize the Skype phone call for Jim Caravella, who was following us. And because they were having trouble getting it to feed properly, they gave us more time. And people really took that time. There was a ton of interest in the audience, so that worked out nicely.
My highlight was about the 20 to 30-minute private talk that Kim and I had with Miguel Albuquerque.
Oh, yeah.
I'm butchering his name. But we caught him before he gave his talk on Monday morning, and apparently they were late getting his talk ready. So we got about 20 minutes, 25 minutes with him, and it was startling. And I hope Miguel follows through and does come on the Space Show. He's really a nice guy, very, very nice guy. I'll tell you my impression, and then I'll turn it over to Kim. But he was there to talk about his warp drive paper. So all of you sit down, because what I'm going to tell you is probably going to blow your mind. He said the paper was written 20, 25 years ago when he was a graduate student. He's never looked at it since. It's not part of his major work. He doesn't care about it. He doesn't think it's feasible because there is no negative mass or negative energy. He has no clue how you would do any of this. He doesn't understand why it caught on and has become a cult. And when I started talking to him about the research being done at NASA JSC with Eagle Works before I think they dissolved, with Paul Marsh, Sonny White, and others, he said he'd never heard from him, ever. Nobody has ever reached out to him. Nobody has ever made an effort to contact him. He's never seen any equations or numbers, and he said anything is totally meaningless without the numbers and analysis. Now, Space Show listeners, where have you heard that before? Run the numbers? Well, Miguel said this is totally meaningless unless you show the equations and run the numbers, and since there's no negative energy and no negative mass, which are basically the same thing, this is, it's totally pie in the sky. And his main work is black holes and gravity waves. And he says he associates with and talks with and collaborates with people in the United States on black holes and gravity holes and throughout Europe all the time. He's easily available. There's no reason why Paul Marsh, Sonny White, Eagle Works, any of these people wanting to research his graduate school paper on warp drive couldn't have contacted him. He's very available. And so he just sort of was mind-boggling. And then he started his talk, and he said basically the same thing. And I loved it because after his talk, all these people are getting up there and referencing the Albuquerque warp drive as a way to get into space in the future. And he had just said it's non-existent. It's worthless. It's not his body of work. It can't be done. And nobody's listening. I mean, it was, to me, I loved it because it just shows how people don't listen, don't understand the process of analysis and running numbers. And he did share these experiences of no feedback, no collaboration.
Yeah.
It's not his body of interest. Kim, were you as surprised as I was?
In some ways. I mean, first of all, it's Miguel Acubier. That's the normal pronunciation.
Yeah, I keep blowing it. I understand that.
Yeah. The thing for me is that he in some ways, it was exactly what I expected in the sense that he's a very polished, very polite person. The kind of person I would expect to be from the upper crust in Mexico City. He wore a very nice shirt and a tie that had gravity waves displayed on it. The threads woven through it in color were gravity waves. And then he had blue jeans and red sneakers. And he was a very charming guy. And he said all these things that he didn't think that research was was going to go anywhere or had real value because they hadn't done the math. But he said it all very politely. He's obviously somebody who's very easy to work with. And when you offered him a show, asked him if he would be on the show, he was open to that immediately. There was no hesitation there at all. I talked to him about Mexico because we both live in Mexico, and we lamented a bit that the young Mexican space agency very much looks like it's not going to go anywhere. And the difficulties of trying to get a space interest really rolling in the kind of society that Mexico is. But he's from UNAM, which is the Universidad Autónoma Nacional de México, which is commonly considered quite possibly the best university in Latin America, not just in Mexico. And it's a really good school, their department and his students and their people could be doing a lot more down there. They just don't have the infrastructure with which to do it. So in that sense, I'll plug a little bit the Spaces for Everybody thing is in that there is a lot more talent out there than is really being tapped right now. And Miguel and what he commented about is a perfect example of that.
When he was giving his talk, he explained why warp drive is not possible using general relativity. Using relativity. And then later he used general relativity and said there might be a back door to it. But since nobody can create negative energy, he doubts it. And he actually gave the numbers and the analysis for it. Following that was Dr. Richard Obese, who's been on the show, including Hotel Mars, maybe four or five times. And he is an interstellar propulsion guy, PhD, physicist, all of that. And he showed the equations and the analysis of the kind of energy it would take if you could create warp drive, and again made it very clear just how outrageously challenging this would be, assuming that you could somehow have some kind of negative energy or negative mass. And it was very interesting. I mean, not everybody could follow the math and the equations, but he did, I think, a pretty good job of simplifying it for most of us in the room. Richard will be back on the show soon as well, too. But then the paper started following for the remainder of the conference, referencing warp drive as a way to go into space and do interstellar in the future. And after those two spoke, nobody even came close to addressing the challenges, the limitations, or the problems that the author of the warp drive paper from 25 years ago said himself, let alone Richard. And I found that to be kind of startling. I mean, people were really devoted to their agenda and to their view of how to have interstellar flight or go into space or all sorts of things. And another theme that struck me, and this showed up in a lot of the questions and answers, were people talking about having children in space and on interstellar missions and raising children. And they seemed oblivious to the challenges of radiation and microgravity for pregnancy, fetal development, babies, children. They just took it, and it seemed to me, and we can get Kim's thoughts on this, that this was a fait accompli, that, children will be going up to the moon and living there and on starships, and we're going to be building these big starships in space because they're too big to build on Earth. And they just dismissed a lot of reality and a lot of fact in their questions and in their presentations. That's my take on a big portion of it, and I think you'll hear that if you watch many of the different presentations once their YouTube channel is complete. Kim, your thoughts on some of this?
Yeah, you know, Icarus has really gone very, very aggressively to the approach of presenting a very positive, aggressive, let's go do it approach to getting back into space. And the very fact that they focus on starships when we haven't been beyond low Earth orbit for several decades is an indication that, bottom line, Icarus Interstellar and their people feel somewhat similar to the way I feel, that if you get people excited about a distant possibility that would change everything, then you can sort out the will needed to do the immediate tasks at hand. However, I would strongly agree that they go way too far in ignoring the challenges in getting there, the gigantic challenges, especially if you start touching on the theme of how you get out of the solar system to somewhere else. It's, you know, Miguel and Richard Obese, they both, you know, maybe there's a tiny chance that this would work out. But what you need to overcome, first of all, is hugely, you know, it's like asking, you know, Bronze Age society to build a nuclear reactor. It's just so far beyond anything we've ever done. It's just not, it's not time yet to start thinking about that. But because they want people to, they enjoy imagining us in space, and they would like other people to enjoy imagining us in space, and they think that wanting to go is the big hurdle we need to get over. They whitewash all this stuff, and it's exactly what you can't do. If you want people to get behind it, you can't then immediately disappoint them by all these problems cropping up. You have to prepare them for that, and there's going to be gigantic difficulties in getting this done. It's not going to be easy at all.
And of course, all of you know, because you listen to the show, that I'm more reality-based rather than, you know, futuristic kind of based. So that's my bent. I did talk about being reality-based in visions and stuff when I introduced the panel. I didn't really get any comments on that. That may or may not have gone over well with the group. But, you know, Kim, there were some talks that I really liked, and one that I was surprised that I was going to like was, they had a young gal there. Well, she's a college graduate, so I don't know how young she was, who is a native Alaskan. I believe she's an Eskimo, and she gave her, I think she said Inuit or Inia,
yeah, it was
Indian.
Yeah, usually I'm used to the word Inuit, but her people was different.
It was different than that,
yeah.
And she spelled it. But as a young girl, Harrison Schmidt came and talked to her school, and she got inspired and motivated. So when she was ready to go off to college, she applied to Emory-Riddle in Daytona and became an aerospace engineer. And then she's back in Alaska now doing some work. But her talk was really interesting because she is from Barrow, Alaska, which is up on the northern slope. And she talked about the characteristics of that really harsh and cruel environment, like many, many months of total darkness, other months of full light, really extreme cold, all sorts of different things, isolation, all that. And she compared it to similar kinds of experiences that astronauts will have traveling to Mars. And I thought her analogies were very good, and she was clear in her thinking. And she's going to come on the space show, but I would very much recommend that when the YouTube channels are up, this is a gal you want to hear talking, and you want to hear her presentation. I don't have the list of speakers in front of me, and I apologize for that. But she's worth listening to, and in the summary of this show, I will list her name so you can find her in the YouTube channel.
Yeah, that was Alice Kanick-Glenn.
That's right, yeah. And I really thought she had great analogies, and I liked her very much. So, and her description of living on the North Slope in Alaska, I wouldn't want to live there. I mean, you really have to be a tough SOB to live there. And, you know, they have some medical, but, you know, if you're really up the creek medically, they have to air evac you out. And hopefully the weather is okay to do that. Otherwise, you may not survive. And it is tough. They go to school. They go to work in total darkness. And they just live with it. And their relationship with their elders and their family members, I mean, we haven't been like that in the lower 49 in probably multiple decades. But it was so refreshing and, to me, really cool to hear how she described their elders and their relationships and the way they're given guidance and inspiration and support, and the way they are corrected and criticized so that they learn as they grow older and can do things. Because the elders will scold them, but they scold them in a way so that they learn to move forward. So look for that show with Alice. This is a really interesting discussion that I think all of you will very much appreciate. Kim, did you have the same thoughts about her presentation as I did?
Yeah, I think the thing is, and it's sort of hard to tease out because she's so within it, she has a certain perspective, and we're so outside of it that it's maybe hard for us to understand. But the thing is that societal models like that is probably what the first small community that has to tough it out on another world will need to use. It's the one that is second nature to us from deep in our past, and rather than sending people who grew up in modern society out to for a few months to try and figure out how we're going to need to do handle social needs and psychological needs in space, you know, it probably is a really good idea to look at peoples that have dealt with an extremely harsh environment generation after generation. It's not that different from what people in a small settlement will need to handle.
So that's one that I liked. Another one was Michelle Hanley, who is an attorney, who carried on a discussion about an organization she's creating. She's an attorney in Connecticut on trying to find a way to protect the Apollo and lunar landing sites and explain why they need to be protected by potential people going up there who might trample the sites, the footprints, contaminate it, even take stuff off the ground. And we've done space shows about this issue before, with people from New Mexico and Australia, because NASA does have a guideline policy but could not get an actual policy in place, because they consider that if NASA had a policy about protecting them, it would mean a property right for the United States, and that's not permitted according to the various treaties. But Michelle talked about her plan to draft a resolution and then present it as a fait accompli to the UN, thinking that this has to come through the UN committee to protect it, and they don't really know how to protect it, and they don't really know how to enforce it. And I mentioned a program that Madhu's graduate student presented on the space show a couple of years ago from Madhu's design class at USC. And this student was putting the Apollo sites under some kind of a dome where you could see through it, but you couldn't approach them. But I thought that was an interesting topic, and I do believe that these sites should be protected. They are absolutely historical, and I would like to see a way found that where protection could be established and enforced. And enforcement is probably, you know, the $64,000 question as to if you even had a policy, how do you enforce it, right? But I thought she was interesting in her approach. She said she was very pro-commercial space and commercial space development, space mining, property rights. So this was not some do-gooder person who wants to keep everyone off the moon and keep your hands off of it and that kind of thing. And then she even made comments during our panel that supported her interest in deep space mining and commercial profits. So, again, her perspective is that she supports much of what I can tell is a sort of a new space, commercial space agenda, but she does want to see those Apollo sites protected, and I support that. Kim, what did you think about Michelle?
Yeah, that was For All Moonkind, and it was really interesting. The organization seems very professional. She showed some ads that they have made up that should start appearing shortly to try and publicize and get support for this idea, because she seems to know exactly what the requirements are. If you're going to get this done through the UN, you need to go into the session where they're actually going to vote on it with all the votes already secured, because you've pre-agreed with it, with all the parties about it. So they had these great ads about you wouldn't do it at home, so why would we do it out there, showing crazy things that make the point about how important these sites are, and you wouldn't. They had a great photo of an Airstream camper on the edge of one of these sites, you know, which of course wouldn't happen, but it's a great example of how people just want to go out there and do things their own way, and you can't have that on sites like that are such an important part of our history. She had another slide that was the imprint in stone in was it the Rift Valley, I think, in Africa, the first human print that they found.
Yeah, the footprint, first human footprint found.
Yeah, and she put that beside Neil Armstrong's first footprint on the moon, and said, you know, these two things are both about equally significant, and I think she's probably right about that. So you can't leave anything to chance on something that's that historic. So I think that's a different angle to come at things, but that is very interesting in how it starts to get the message out there that, you know, we haven't done anything for a while. Maybe it seems slow. Maybe it's hard for ordinary people to imagine exactly why this is important. But it is really important. One day people are going to look back at this age and say, this was when the tipping point happened. This was the key moment. And any new way of getting that across is really valuable. And she was very sharp. She was a very sharp woman.
So she has a website. I'll put the URL in the archives. I don't know if the ads are on her website, but she did put them up, so the streaming video will absolutely show the ads, and they're really first rate. I mean, you will really enjoy the ads. Whoever has helped them create them did a bang-up job on that. Kim, we have a comment from Fremont John, who unfortunately could not join us this morning, but he did post a comment to the blog about our show. He's catching up on 3 days of missed work where he works. So he says, David and Kim, I'm unable to call in as I'm doing digging myself out of a 3-day hole at work. I was generally disappointed with the Starship Congress, and we'll comment on that in just a minute. I felt they focused too much on politically correct theme of space is for everyone. Where have you guys heard that one before? With the implied assumption that there is some sort of discrimination going on, apparently by white males, against women and minorities, preventing them from going to space. O'Neill's vision in the high frontier and for the Space Studies Institute, by the way, Fremont John has been a member of the Space Studies Institute for many years, and Gary Hudson, who is the director of it right now, is our guest on Tuesday night this coming week, and was always about getting as many people into space as possible, regardless of race or class. Obviously, we want all humans in a thriving civilization in space, not just geezer white guys or rich folks. There was not one talk on the gravity prescription, the most important piece of research needed to make moonwards possible or settlements on Mars. We know about radiation effects and the needed mitigation, but it may never be possible to have children on the moon without significant genetic modification or horrendous logistic shuttling back and forth between 1G environments and early child development, as Kim suggests. Kim's talk was awesome, though. Bravo for moon words. I want to read you, if I can find it real quickly, because he sent me, Kim and I left early, because I did not want to drive back to the Bay Area through a lot of crap, traffic, and, you know.
And I was totally in agreement about that.
So he was texting me, and let me see maybe it's not a text that he sent me. Maybe he sent me an email. But Kim does have a good idea about possibly having to take pregnant women off the moon. Let's just confine it for now to the lunar base and get them back to 1G, because we can't deal with some of the issues that we're talking about. Kim, do you want to explain that?
Yeah, actually, it partly came out of work that was mentioned during the Congress, and the talk by Jim Logan and John Jurist a few days before, which I listened to just last night, actually, because I was on the go. But even though I have tried to be conservative in the way things are designed for moon words, that was one that I had still underestimated how extremely difficult it is to ensure safety for a mother and an unborn child in space. And so trying to come up with some way to revise the plan to include that, because the thing is, Moonworks is trying to model the future that we're reaching for, and it's trying to do it as accurately as possible. So, you know, that's why I'm forced to ignore monetary restrictions, because whatever money it takes, eventually we have to do it. So I have to skip over that and find some way to show what we would have to do according to the best estimate we can make. But getting over that one, you know, trying to consider what that new data, the only thing I can come up with is that you'd have to actually build motherships. And when I say motherships, what I mean is ships that are specifically for mothers. So that when you find out that they're pregnant, and this, of course, is after there'd be quite a bit of infrastructure and quite a large population on the moon, so you've had time to study this and figure out what the risks are. But you'd have to specifically make the effort to detect pregnancies within the first few days, and if you detect one, you'd have to evacuate that woman back to Earth immediately. And because of the radiation on the surface and in the trip between here and Earth, you would have to have a humongous ship that had the shielding necessary to do that, and that ship would have to be able to lift that woman and get her back there safely. So, you know, it's going to be a rather crazy thing, but the thing is, as far as I can tell right now from the input I have, you know, that's the only way to do it. You have to find a way to do that. Get her there safe. And then, you know, John on the panel made the point that this may be the thing that, as he said in the email comment, there may not be any way to do it on the moon. I think we have to reach for that anyhow. But it may be that O'Neill cylinders are the only way to live in space, at least in the near term, because of that issue, that it's only in a cylinder where you could create the gravity environment and the low radiation environment that would be safe for pregnancy. So I'm trying to find some way to combine that with the settlement on the moon, where again, if you discover that somebody is pregnant, you immediately move them to that environment, and they would have to stay there until it's safe for mother and child to come back. And that sounds very challenging, all right. But you know, if you model it, maybe you can figure out the best way to do it. And even if you don't, you get the message out there. But exactly how huge this challenge is, so that people can start to prepare themselves for facing that challenge.
Yeah, there wasn't much critical thinking at the conference about this. Instead, it was more or less that there was an assumption in place that children would be going to the moon and going on starships and going to space, and nobody was really thinking about how that might happen, nor were they skeptical about that happening, which is what John pointed out and what Kim and I mentioned earlier in the show. You know, Kim, as we were driving back, if you recall, John sent me an email just short of 5 o'clock, so the talks were still going on. I don't know who was presenting, and he said, "Be glad you left early." And he gave us a slide. He took a picture with a cell phone of a slide from the talk. And again, I don't know who this talk was by. I guess we could find out given the timestamp on the email. So it says society, and it's got a statue of Lady Justice, I guess. And it says bulleted, no system of control, money, religion, work, and laws. Next bullet point. Money segregates and generates greed. Next bullet point. Religion should be studied as part of philosophy. Next bullet point. Work should be task-based to allow for more human interaction instead of profit. Final bullet point. Laws don't work, education does. And again, his tagline on the email to our group, it went to Kim and to Chaim and to me, was "Be glad you left early." So there was a focus toward that kind of thing when we were talking during the panel, and we got off topic a little bit in the panel, but at one point one of the co-founders of the Starship, Mike, asked a question to me about what about all these people who sort of want to go to the moon and divvy it up for profit? How does that work with the moon being for everyone? And my take on what he was saying is that's kind of not okay, that nobody should be able to have any part of the moon or any profits, that all of this is to be shared with humanity, and you don't get any exclusive use to moon territory as you would now under the OST by producing a product or revenue stream. And then you could hold that like leasehold for your business. So I went on to one of my rants. I don't know how long it lasted, but maybe 10 or 15 minutes.
No, it wasn't that long.
It was too long. And because I really disagreed with him, and that's when I said I thought space for all meant that everybody gets to share in the value and benefits and the changes for the good that space can bring to everybody on Earth, whether they're poor or handicapped or disabled or they live in Africa or whatever. It doesn't necessarily mean that everybody gets to go to space, but you can certainly, no matter where you live in the world, benefit from space. And I said, you know, the mining companies, the people that are making money, they're going to be paying taxes, and the taxes get used to help with a lot of social programs, and the value that they create in their products, those products get distributed around the world. And I use the pharmaceutical industry, which may be a bad model because it is a greed-laced model, but I use that as a model, since most pharmaceuticals are made in America and Switzerland in some Western countries and under license in China and Israel and India. But people all over the world benefit from those pharmaceuticals, and they pay varying rates. In the U.S., we pay the highest rates because of our policy, but a lot of these pharmaceuticals are distributed for free or next to free in many, many countries around the world. So there was this theme there that did have a bit of a sort of an anti-commercial kind of overtone, in my opinion. And at this point, Michelle offered a comment and saying, and that's when she said she supports space mining and the outer space rules, where you could hold that territory as long as you're doing something productive and generating revenue, and that's good, and it benefits a lot of people. So I had a much broader view of spaces for everybody, and I don't think it just means that everybody gets to go to space. There was early on a presentation that I missed, but Kim did hear it, about someone making the case for all sorts of people, regardless of gender or race or disability or whatever, to go to space. And maybe Kim can talk about that. I missed it, and from what I heard about it, I probably wouldn't go back and listen to it on the archives. But I think you wondered if that was even appropriate at the conference, right?
Yeah. If we're thinking of the same person.
Yeah, it was the first day early in the morning.
Yeah. My objection to it was not so much the content as the fact that that you're getting hugely ahead of where we're at right now. I agree. I don't see much sign at all that NASA especially discriminates at all. She was starting. Nominally, the talk was going to be about, at least this is what was interesting to me about it, about design in space to try and consider accessibility, which has some merit. Still kind of getting ahead of ourselves, but okay. But there was almost no specifics, and mostly it was a commentary on the importance of accessibility in general. But, you know, NASA isn't there yet. As far as including minorities and women, NASA has done as much as it can, and I applaud them for that. But you just can't take somebody with a disability or a different kind of different ability to space. It's too harsh an environment, and there's too much risk. You just can't do it still. And we aren't going to be able to do it in any future project that is on anybody's drawing board right now. That's decades away. So my issue with it really was that there was a certain accusatory tone there, and a tone of asking something when you haven't done the work yet. To me, actually, that's how I sum up my objection to people making these points. It's not that they're bad points. It's that they have not done the work yet to be to have a voice at the table. And I don't think that they should be making demands before they've done that, because it's clear from what their demands are that they don't understand the context. They're young. They're imagining a big future in space, and because social values is a big part of what they think about. They have a commentary about that, but they don't know the context, and they have not done the work, and they should not be making accusatory statements because they haven't done that yet.
Again, I didn't hear the talk, but my view is that I have never in, the 25 years of doing things with space, come across any organization or any individual that puts a limitation on who can go to space based upon disability, gender, sex, race, whatever, or country of origin, religion. I've just never, ever seen it. It's sort of an unwritten space is for everyone kind of thing.
Actually, I would point out, and I mentioned this to Al Globus, who was sitting next to us, because we had this whole conversation, and I said, okay, yeah, but actually, you know what? When I was at the league meeting in 2015, I guess it was, they put up a slide of the new graduating class of astronauts in Europe, and there was not a single woman. And that did bother me. So there are some places, at least in other agencies, where this is an issue.
Well, I guess nothing is perfect, but I guess it's probably not enough to dwell a whole lot on. But that was sort of an overriding theme. I did hear private conversations with people during the breaks and the networking, where they were talking about. The spaces for everyone theme is more important than the competency or what they would be doing in space. So I do think that this is a priority this is probably a number one priority goal for Starship Congress, but it would not be my priority goal. But if someone offered a space program with limitation, I would probably not be, you know, very supportive of something like that. On the other hand, not everyone can go to space or should go to space, nor should space necessarily accommodate everyone. So again, I'll use the example of my son with cystic fibrosis. There would be huge medical issues.
Oh, yeah.
And let's say you had the technology to deal with something like that in a microgravity and radiation environment. So is that something to accommodate someone's wishes that you spend money on? I don't know. I mean, I'm, you know, maybe if my son had a particularly valuable skill that was needed for the survival of a Mars colony or an interstellar flight or something, maybe the value of his or her contribution is worth accommodating that kind of special need. On the other hand, he should be able to benefit from what people do in space freely. And the reason I like to use this as an example, the basic defect of space of cystic fibrosis was discovered by Dr. DeLuca, and I have space shows about this from many years ago, by doing protein crystal growth on the space shuttle. Mm. And they were able to break the CF gene apart in microgravity and see how it worked when it was apart with a lot of spaces in it that you can't do on Earth. And from that, the basic defect was finally understood, and labs all over the world got that information, and all of the targeted genetic material coming out to change the life of people with this illness stem from that very basic space bit of research. So that is, to me, why space is for everyone. And that benefit is available around the world. It's not just available to people in the United States with health insurance. So that's how space is for everyone, is how I understand it. I don't believe that it necessarily means every person, every race, every gender, every this, every that is supposed to go to space. I don't believe that's either feasible or desirable or practical. But what they do there needs to come back and be distributed so that people all around the world can benefit from it.
Yeah, I think we'd all agree that if we had a highway into space, that anybody should be able to go on it and go. But we're so far from that, it's just, you can't even really talk about it. You know, I thought that when you made that comment, specifically about how benefits in space, that it's very important that that goes to everybody, and that it has, sort of up to now, that space, discoveries made in space and the technology made for use in space has been more open and more available to everybody than in most sectors of the economy. And I think you struck a chord when you said that. I think you got a real response from people there. So it's good that you said that. You know, when Mike was saying about, he used the example of private properties taking up beaches in Florida.
Right.
So I guess there's a thing there that essentially getting worried about elitism in a lunar society, that once you actually have a society, maybe there would be people who have, you know, the drudge jobs, and then other people who get to use the expensive, all the expensive infrastructure that's required for, to be able to go outside and to have an actual window or things like that. You know, maybe that's a valid concern, but it's so far away. We can do design work on it to try and anticipate how designs could be made so that it's comfortable for everybody. But talking about societal models is just so hard to do right now, and especially for people who have physical difficulties or mental differences or gender differences. All that stuff that's just so, it's just too hard to think about that right now.
And I did mention that I, this will probably anger a lot of you, but I do favor a reasonable regulatory regime for different kinds of policy and laws and behavior in space. I'm not for free-for-alls and chaos, and I am also not one to think that all companies and all private parties will self-regulate for the good. I'm not that naive. The trick is to balance whatever regulations are developed so that you don't kill commercial development and incentives and inspiration through over-regulation, and that regulation helps foster the goals of what you want with space development and space economics. But as Kim says, we're not really there yet. I mean, right now we can't even get people back to the moon. So we're kind of jumping the gun here. By the way, speaking about that, and when Ben Arroyo was giving his talk about how you engineer and design lunar structures and everything, just as he was ending, I asked him a timeline, if we started now, for actually getting back to the moon to stay. And that was actually the theme of our panel, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
He surprised me, and he said, you know, maybe a decade and a half, that he didn't see any way of doing this any earlier. And I told him I didn't like his answer. So that's as if we started today, but listeners, we're not starting today. And that, to me, is a big problem. And as I think I said at some point, and others said too, the issue isn't technology, and the issue isn't really the money. It is the lack of leadership and capability to take us forward by those who do have leadership positions in the private sector as well as on the public side. And I've been saying that for years, and I stand by that. That is where the juggernaut is. It's on the leadership and policy side. It's not on the TRLs and on the money side. Kim, comments from you on that area?
I think that I would generally agree with that. You know, timelines, I've never liked talking about timelines because we get caught up with that. But, you know, and I'm not a technical person, but yeah, I think we just have to, we need to keep our eye on the broad picture here. Personally, I hate getting caught in the details, although I know it's very important. The industry is in very good shape, and it's growing quickly, and I think we should all be glad about that.
Kim, you have an email from Ted in San Diego. And he says, Kim, I'd like your perspective on the Starship Congress's networking opportunities. David mentioned that there were only around 60 to 70 people there. Did you find the networking to be satisfactory? Was it inadequate? Was it a real part of the conference and a value added? Or how did you perceive it?
That's a very interesting question because that, of course, is one of the main reasons why I went. That's why most people go to conferences. You're trying to connect with other people who are really working on this so that you can do things together. I have only been to a few conferences, so for me it's easier to meet that requirement to justify the expense because it is a big expense. And actually, I would say that there are some things that are very nice about a small conference in that sense. Using David as an in was helpful for me because he's much more broadly known. But I was able to speak for 10 or 15 minutes or more with Miguel Acubier, with David Brin, with Alan Hale, with all the big names that were there and anybody I wanted to talk to because. There wasn't a huge crowd of people trying to get at them. I actually wanted to say that I was pleasantly surprised, and maybe you don't notice this at larger conferences because they're multi-track, but this only had one track, And I looked around the room a number of times. And for the most part, those big names and those people who have been in the scene for a very long time and certainly have heard it all before, they went to almost all the talks. And they often asked questions, very good questions, pointed questions that made it very clear that they were trying to be helpful to the person on the stage. So that's a great thing about small conferences. And personally, I got a bunch of cards. After my presentation in the panel, I got a few people offering to volunteer or make a contribution to Moonwords that could turn out to be very important. It could, in fact, be somebody that I met at this conference that makes the real difference so that I can get the key things done in Moonwords and move on to the next level quickly and do that properly. And that was one of the reasons why going to a conference not so very far from Silicon Valley struck me as a good idea, because I need coders and I need people who understand internet technology. It was good in that sense. I don't think the organizers were able to properly create the environment that supports that in the best way. It's hard being the new conference in town. I understand that they felt that the best way to be supportive was to make sure that everybody had the space to speak. But I strongly agree with David that in the end, the needs of the group outneed the needs of the individual on this. You need to limit the time that people are speaking to the time that was agreed beforehand. And if you're going to give someone more than the half-hour slot that was the baseline standard, they better have a good reason why. When I speak, I make a big effort to keep my speech below 20 minutes because, as people will know from TED, that's the amount of time that people can really pay attention properly. And if you go longer than that, unless you pace it very carefully, people are just going to forget most of what you said. They had a lot of young people who aren't very experienced in speaking in public. And if you don't crack the whip and tell them, no, you have to cut it down. You have to cut it down and stay under that half hour. They will feel that they have so much they need to say that they go over time, they aren't experienced enough to know that they could have cut it down. You can cut it down, and it's in your interest to cut it down, because people will remember it better, and they'll have a chance to ask questions, and will still be interested in asking questions, because you haven't rattled on for an hour. They could have put in more breaks, and they could have had a proper mixer afterwards if they had made sure that people stuck to their time, and they just didn't have the heart to push people that way. I think they need to learn to be that harsh.
I commented, I think, on the second day to Andrea, and I said, are you going to be able to control the time of the speakers better today? And he says, no, that's not what we're all about. Everybody gets to say whatever it is they need to say. That's what Starship Congress is about. So they really didn't want to do that and didn't feel, as Kim and I felt, and by the way, John and Ben Arroyo felt the same way as we did, and probably other people too. They didn't feel that controlling the time and sticking to time was important. The loosey-goosey approach is what they identify with, and so that's what it was, for good or for bad. And as I said, the second day was a 12-hour day. It was very, very long. There were no social mixers for networking, so the only opportunity you got was during the breaks and during lunch, and then if you saw somebody in the hotel lobby, you could go up and talk to them, but people didn't break off together, for any like happy hour or anything like what you normally have where people mix together. It just wasn't there, because they ran programs into the evening, and then when the evening ended around 9 o'clock, that they scattered for the four corners of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
So I missed that. I missed some kind of a social get-together for everybody there that was longer than 10 minutes or so. What did you like best about the Congress? Was there one or two speakers that we haven't mentioned that really stood out for you?
Yeah, well, Alan Hill gave a great talk, and Andreas made a point afterwards of thanking him and coming up to the stage and thanking him for his contribution to the field of astronomy. And I like that moment as well, because Alan is getting on. He's retired now. And there are a few people there who are getting on, but Alan specifically he's retired, and he's drawing back from the scene now. So moments like that are nice. And I really like Angela Vermeulen's talk about modeling a generational ship, a ship. He had done some very interesting work on that. But again, one of the things that really stuck out in my mind about that is that they had some very innovative designs, and I really want to go over his talk again when it's posted. But they had to ignore the question of radiation and the question of microgravity, which are the two critical things you have to handle in order to get anywhere safely, because they just aren't there yet. There's too many things to consider. The modeling is already challenging enough. So I like that little injection of reality. And after him was Christoph Latz, and he's one of the classic examples. We had to step out. There was things we needed to do. I have to pace myself at a conference, because I get tired after a while. And if I start getting tired, that just won't go away unless I do something about it. But he also had a very interesting talk, and I was able to talk to him afterwards about that. And he's actually somebody I'd be interested in seeing on the show, both of those people. He was talking about the data that started to come back from the twin study of the Kellys last year, and how strangely their DNA responded to the time and space. Really interesting stuff. Their telomeres got longer. I won't go into the technical stuff about that. Their DNA demethylated. This is really strange stuff, and is going to really change the calculations about how we think about health and space in the long term. And let's see. I'm going through the list of people on their page to see who I recognize, and so it twigs me about the other talks that I really enjoyed. Oh, Juan José Díaz Infante. I also only saw part of his talk, but he was mostly educating in Mexico on space, and actually getting people interested in doing real projects and doing some real work, but not much that, you know, not a real project that's going to actually have a any sort of business in space or anything like that. But an excellent educator and an excellent person that communicates about space. There were a bunch of really good talks. Those are the ones. I'm going to stop there. There were other talks that I liked, but those are the people that. Oh, Nick Nielsen. His talk was a sociology talk. It was the only one of the ones that was a sociology-based talk to me that really made sense. I really enjoyed his work as well.
And he is a Space Show guest. Listeners, you will remember that he was going to be on with Frank White, and he has sort of something called the Mars Overview Effect that we were going to talk about. And Frank was unable to be on the show that day, so Nick and I did the entire show together. And he takes you off of Earth for the Overview Effect and sort of looks at the Moon and Mars and sort of an Overview Effect from a different perspective at a different place in our solar system. So Nick and I had a lot of discussions during the break, and he will be back on the show and will be talking about his presentation, which had a lot of slides to it, so it would have to be modified for radio, but I'm sure he can do that. Very interesting guy, and very creative in how he sees things and puts things together. And I think you'll find his comments when he comes back on the show very good. For me, this was really fertile grounds for finding maybe 10 shows out of it and reoccurring guests for the show, because many of these people will be on, like John Bucknell is used to be a SpaceX engineer for the Raptor project. He has a really interesting propulsion system for spaceflight that he described there, and he's coming on October 10th on the show, and we'll probably have some PowerPoints or views that we will post to the blog to help you understand what he's talking about. But very creative guy, and he was the lead engineer on Raptor, and then he left SpaceX and is an individual, independent consultant. So would you go to another spaceship congress? I think they're to be held every 2 years, correct?
Yeah, you know, it's always really tough for me to choose conferences. I don't think at this stage, certainly, it makes sense for me to go to more than one or two conferences a year. At a later stage, maybe it would be a good idea for me to go to four or five, but right now I can't do more than that. And so part of my calculation is, what are the other big ones that I haven't hit yet? And so it would surprise me if I go to the next one, because I need to go to New Space, I need to go to AIAA. There's a bunch of them that I should probably check out.
Were you pleased with the feedback and the reaction you got to Moonwords?
Yes. Yes, very much so. I also was intrigued by some of the objections, because when people have an emotional, it isn't just that they say, oh, well, that was crappy, that they are a little upset about your approach. Well, they've invested in it emotionally. So that's already a good sign, even though they don't like some of my decisions. It at least means that they seem to think that I might be able to get this message across, and that's what I'm trying to do. So I don't mind them being angry. And I try to listen to people have criticisms as well. So, in fact, when people criticize a project, to me, that's what I want most. That's what you really need. People who are skilled people, people who gave presentations gave me their card and seemed, four, gave me cards and seemed genuinely interested in collaborating. So, one thing I got from the conference is that a lot of people who are, outgoing and, project oriented tend to have their own ideas and make their own project, and it makes it very hard to collaborate because you all tend to want to go your own ways because you have your own vision and you want to pursue it. But I really hope I can figure out how to collaborate with these people. I think they could be a big asset to the project.
And you don't have to answer this if you don't want to, but any projects talked about, ideas, or things where you totally rolled your eyes in your heads and wondered, what the hell is this all about, or is this for real? Was there anything so on the fringe or beyond the fringe that you took note in sort of a skeptical way?
Yes.
Do you want to tell us which one struck you that way, or do you just want to leave it at that?
That's probably better to leave it at that.
Some of the people will be on the show later on, listeners, but I will not introduce them as those that Kim is talking about or that I might talk about. And I'll let you decide what you think about that. I will do this. Do you all remember a gentleman called in on an open line show to talk about his idea called Skyhook? And he talked for about 15 or 20 minutes and talked about having a self-published book on Skyhook. And there were quite a few blog comments on his participation in Open Lines. And most of those blog comments were pretty critical of his Skyhook idea. And some were argumentative, as Eagle, who is the person involved, can be argumentative if you don't like his idea. Well, he was there, and he made a presentation the first day, and he was an active participant in many of the discussion Q&As. And when he offered Q&A discussion, it was all about producing low-cost space access, and he has the way to do that, and you have to be following the Skyhook way. And I did not get an opportunity to talk to him one-on-one or even with a small group, but you did.
Yeah.
So I'm curious if you will share us your experience of Eagle and, I mean, he talked for an hour, so he obviously had much more to say about his idea than he did on his open lines call. First of all, should I invite him to do a full program? Because he did get an awful lot of resistance and criticism on the blog for that 10 or 15 minutes.
You know, actually, I would say yes. Eagle Sarmont, I said this to him because I talked to him for a while, because Eagle has a skill set I could really use. So, but I do genuinely think that although ultimately I disagree with him, and we butted heads about that a lot, he knows what he's talking about. In terms of technical stuff, he does know what he's talking about. He just underestimates the problems. But as far as the math and the physics and all that stuff, he knows exactly what he's talking about. So, he keeps coming back to the point that, you know, the different parts of this combination system that he thinks would be the way to go, each piece is being worked on by different companies, and the plan is moving forward. I kept saying, yeah, but it doesn't make sense to put them together and try to aim for that as being the launch system that we pursue now or any time in the near future, because it's too complex. Of course, complexity is something that engineers can argue about with great gusto and get into all kinds of arcane things about it. You know, how much complexity is enough? Is the complexity worth it if there's enough of a payoff? It's a very complicated calculation considering that. I think his system is way too complex, and that it could never be done for that reason, largely for political reasons. But also, even aside from that, I have a feeling there'd be too... My very outsider point of view is that reliability would go down if you tried to do all the different pieces that he would want to put into it, possibly by quite a lot, and so therefore it isn't worth it. He thinks that each individual piece is simple enough that reliability would be fine. My big criticism of Eagle is that he doesn't communicate well enough on the parts that people don't agree with him about. However, I think the technical side of his plan is sound. I just think that he doesn't want to include a bunch of factors that are the things that ultimately undermine it.
Of course, the bottom line to me is nobody's picking up on his idea or even thinking about implementing any part of it. And the people involved in creating space access or lowering the cost for space access are not... At least it appears that nobody's even interested in considering something like that. So he's between a rock and a hard place to disseminate his idea, but to disseminate it to people who would have the interest in the funding and the capability of doing something with it. So he's kind of, at, from my perspective, at a dead end.
Well, this was a problem for me with a lot of the presentations, actually, is that a lot of people really wanted to present the end-to-end solution for everything. John Bucknell actually took a very similar approach.
But although he has, I think, some more avenues, but he still has a lot of the same problems that Eagle has.
Yeah, but the thing is, if your skill set is that you would like to see something developed, the worst possible thing you can do is try to propose a complete solution to everything, because, you know, I mean, the only reason why Elon can do that is because he had the resources to come up with his own company, and even at that, you know, he understands that, okay, he wants to do all these things, but right now the main thing is he got to make a rocket, and they are never going to be in Elon's position. So if you actually want to change the technology, if that's your skill set and that's where you have particular proposals, you have to focus on one thing, and you have to do it through business avenues. He talked to the, I'm going to call him the NIAC scout who was there. I believe it was Ron Taylor. I may have gotten that name a little wrong. Very sweet guy. But he was there checking out who was talking because, you know, NIAC is always looking for great new ideas, and they try to help people get into the system and get used to the format and start working with them. And Eagle spoke to him. And maybe that's an avenue. But again, NIAC is a research institution. If you're going to work with them, you have to pick one thing and focus on it and develop it. You can't try to create a whole infrastructure, a whole different entire space industry.
Kim, we're close to a 90-minute show. My thought that we would do this for about an hour doesn't seem to be very reliable here. What are we omitting? What have we overlooked? What do you think we should say in terms of debriefing this experience?
Let's see. I mean, conferences are very overwhelming experiences, really. You get a tidal wave of information thrown at you. In my mind, this conference raises a lot of questions about the best way to do a conference and the best way to get your money's worth out of the conference. And in some ways, I think they went too much with the hype and didn't focus on format enough, didn't organize it enough. I'll debrief myself and go over the talks later on. And I don't know. I got a lot out of it. I'm really glad I was there. I'm really glad I met all of them, including Mike and Andreas and Damien, the organizers. There's a lot of good people out there. It was a good experience.
So listeners, they do have a YouTube channel, and as we said, the talks are not all up there, and the ones that are up there are not edited to the point where you know who's speaking in the videos that are up there. But if you go to YouTube and go to Icarus Interstellar 2017, you will find, I believe, two sets of videos that were there. At least that's what it was before we started our program this morning. Hopefully they will edit and tell you who's speaking in each segment, and we'll have that information. But many, many more talks have to go up there, and hopefully those videos are okay and they can put them up there. I read the comments on one, and there seemed to be a lot of criticism about audio quality. Hello, I hear that one a lot.
Although they did record the audio separately through a separate channel, as far as I could tell. And I think that's part of the reason why they stopped posting them live. They're trying to make sure that they improve the audio before they post them.
Yeah, and space shell programs are single-track audio, but we're radio. There's no visual here. So separate track audio is really great. I wish we were doing that so that I was on a separate track and Kim was on a separate track and callers would be on a separate track. But we don't have those resources. But let's hope they get it together. You have a final comment. I'll address it to you, Kim, because that seems to be more appropriate. This is from Adrian, who's also in San Diego. A question I have regarding all conferences is that of a value-added contribution effect to measure its success. Did this conference bring even distant human civilization any closer to real interstellar travel and exploration? With the numbers of believers in questionable space propulsion claims, M-drives, and such distracting actual advances in space travel, and the evident lack of focus by society, at least in this country, to at least a viable plan for an expedient human form of interplanetary travel and settlement, shouldn't all these space conferences focus on a unified effort by space proponents in attempting to influence leadership in accomplishing this goal? I'm really looking forward to listening to Franklin Diaz on Monday as someone who is realistically developing space drives that will allow something other than infrequent or sporadic flights to Mars and elsewhere in our solar system. Adrian, so you want to take a crack at that one?
Well, it's hard to say, you know, when the moment happens where two people have a little conversation and agree that they're going to collaborate or that one person takes a new point of view away from that, you don't know until long, long after that moment that that was an important moment. So maybe one of those moments occurred at the conference. There's no way to know. Certainly when you go and spend all that money to go to one of these things, you know, you come away not really being sure in a lot of ways whether it was really worth your money or not. The proof comes months later when you realize that you have been able to incorporate an idea or work with somebody, or that you discarded an idea thanks to somebody's contribution there. You know, it's one of those acts of faith. A conference is sort of a huge act of faith of listening to each other. So, you know, you do what you got to do.
And Adrian, I would believe or would support what Kim is saying. And I think it's unrealistic to think that any conference, let's say you went to an AIAA propulsion conference, which is all peer-reviewed and very high-tech and all of that, does that really bring us closer to leaving Earth and going to Mars or settling on Mars or going interstellar? Did my programs with Dr. Phil Lubin of Breakthrough, who explained what they're working on with wafers and wanting to go to 30% of light speed on the way to Proxima 4, maybe in 50 or 70 years, does that bring us any closer? So much of that is subjective, but you never know what may develop from a contact you make, a comment you hear, something that someone else hears. So it's very hard to put a cost value on a conference other than on an individual basis. So for me, I'm very glad I went. And for me, the way I evaluate the conference is, number one, I had a great time. I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed kicking back with Ben Arroyo, with John, and with Kim. I needed that kind of time and that kind of fun in the evening and at restaurants and sitting with all of them during the thing. And by the way, Ben Arroyo's wife was there, and I got to meet Shelley and sat with her at lunch a couple of times and had really great conversations with her, very perceptive, sharp woman. I met a lot of people at the conference that I've not met before, and I have new shows coming up. And I've been talking about Miguel and his warp drive ever since Sonny White was on the show 6 or 7 years ago with Eric Davis and Richard Obese. And I met him and got the facts about it, and he will be on the show. And the same with Richard. I finally got to put a face to him. I can't put a value on that. And it's also a value for listeners because I can give you better programming. Does any of this mean we're that much closer to interstellar travel? Probably not. But does it mean that I got value out of the conference and I'm glad I went? Absolutely. I'm absolutely very, very happy that I chose to go to this conference. And I do think it was worth every penny that I paid or will be paying for it as the credit card bills come in. At the New Space Conference, did they get us any closer to being a totally commercial space-driven economy in space or a lunar settlement or anything like that? Probably not. But again, I met a lot of people. I heard a lot of great ideas, new business ventures. I've been talking about the panels from the New Space Conference, the entrepreneurism, the inspiration, the young people starting companies and getting venture capital funding, women from India starting companies. Listen to that, Starship, you know, Congress, equal access to everybody. Absolutely. So I guess how people evaluate a conference is different for everybody. So for me, it was a very valuable and a lot of fun and a very good learning experience. And I think Spatial listeners will absolutely have value in the future from the programming that comes forth from being there. Does it mean we're going to get to interstellar space flight a lot sooner? Probably not, because I don't think the people there, other than maybe Miguel and Richard and one or two other people, are really working the math and the science and the quantum physics and stuff to this problem. In fact, I talked with Richard a lot about quantum physics during the times that we talked to one another. But what I do think is that it raises the consciousness of people about interstellar flight. These 60 or 70 people will go out and share their experiences. There'll be a little overview effect, you know. So, you know, maybe they'll share their experiences with 5 or 6 or 7 people who will then say to somebody else, hey, Joe Blow went to this flight about interstellar. I bought an interstellar T-shirt, and I wore it all day yesterday, and I did go out doing certain things, and one of the places I went was a dental appointment, and the receptionist at the dentist and the hygienist started asking me about interstellar spaceflight and what it was, and why would we even think about it? And in between having tools all over my mouth and spitting and this and that and the other, I spent an hour talking interstellar flight with the dental hygienist because I wore the Interstellar Congress T-shirt. So does that play a role in helping to have a space-faring, interstellar-faring Congress? Well, it's in their consciousness now. I can't tell you what it may mean for their children or for their neighbors. Maybe nothing, maybe something. But, you know, I do believe that it only takes one person to make a huge difference, and you never know when you're going to meet that one person. So you have to be open to opportunity coming from out of no place, including the least expected, the most unexpected, weird places ever. An opportunity may hit you, and if you're closed off or you don't make yourself available to opportunities coming from 360 degrees, you miss it. And so will opportunity for advancing us toward interstellar spaceflight come to someone who attended this conference or sees the YouTube videos? I can't tell you that. But I can tell you that opportunity will come from this conference for the 70 people that were there and the hundreds that will see it on YouTube. And whether they miss that opportunity or seize it will be up to them. And you just never know when dynamite gets ignited and we're off to the races because someone, someplace, got a bug up their butt and did something about it. Like the Eskimo, who at a very young age met Harrison Schmitt talking about his experiences going to the moon and went on to become an aerospace engineer and is playing a role in talking to NASA about long-duration space flight, harsh environment issues, because she's able to take her experiences growing up in Barrow, which sounded dreadful. I don't know who would want to live there. I don't even think my Siberian Husky would want to live there. And I did ask her about dogs in Barrow and Huskies, by the way. You just never know. And so, Adrian, keep an open mind. I know you're a scientist, and keeping open minds as scientists for things that are qualitative and not scientific can often be hard to do, but what the hell? What's the downside in keeping an open mind? Kim, any concluding comments? And Adrian, thank you very much for the question. That's a great way to conclude the show today. Any final thoughts from you, Kim?
Not much. I gotta say, for me, possibly the most important part of coming to this particular conference is that I got to know you, because we've already been collaborating a fair bit, and I hope that's going to grow over the coming years. So, and I had a good time with you, and I had a great time with all of, you know, Shelley and Chaim and John. It all went very well.
Listeners, that's it for today. So a couple of quick announcements. We do have our Sunday program, but Monday's going to be a little bit different, because Franklin's office has notified me that they have a congressional visit going on Monday afternoon. So we're going to start our Monday program, and I'll put this in the newsletter, about 15 minutes late on purpose. So instead of a 2 p.m. start time Pacific for the show with Eric Seedhouse and Franklin, we're going to start it at about 2:15. And Franklin has between 60 and 70 minutes to give us, not the full 90 minutes. We may keep Eric for the full 90 minutes. We'll see how that goes. But we will not take a break. And we will start probably a few minutes before 2:15. But just a heads up that that's going to be marginally delayed start time on Monday. And Gary Hudson is on Tuesday. And Lockheed Flight Simulation for Mars, a program that was recently announced, is going to be the subject of our Hotel Mars on Wednesday. And then you'll have to read the upcoming shows and the newsletters to see what's scheduled for Friday and Sunday. Well, I guess I should tell you Friday because that's weird too. I'm going to try something new. I'm moving the Friday show on the 18th to 7 p.m. at night, and it's going to be open lines. I have no clue what kind of reception the show will get. I don't believe I have ever done a Friday evening program. I'm curious to see if there's any interest in it or any response. So Friday, when you see the time, it's not an error. It is a special time, 7 p.m. It is open line. And let's see how it works. And maybe we'll have an additional day that's pretty good for phone calls on open lines, or maybe it'll bomb out and y'all don't want to have a space show program on Friday night. But that's what we're doing on Friday the 18th. So keep that in mind, 7 p.m. It will not be a morning show a week from today. Special thanks to Kim, who is here vacationing and sightseeing and having a great time in the Bay Area, for taking time off to do this special space show program. We certainly appreciate that. And I personally appreciate her organizing our panel, combining Ben Arroyo, John, and myself and her Moonwards talk into our panel, which I hope all of you will watch when it is up on the Icarus website. She brought a great group together, and that is a real testament to Kim's draw and to the work that she does. So I want to shout out for that for her and for Moonwards and thank her for that. Everybody come back on Sunday and have a great weekend coming up. Keep it safe and keep looking up. Goodbye from Kim Holder, Moonwards, and myself.